Let's cultivate our motivation. Make sure we're all here doing the same thing in terms of what our aims are. And so to have the motivation to learn about ourselves, to develop our good qualities, particularly compassion, open-mindedness, generosity, and ethical conduct. And may we do this so that we can not only transform ourselves, but contribute to the overall well-being of society and of the planet. So we're placing what we're doing as an individual within a big picture, a long-term picture, and a compassionate one. Okay, so last time we did chapters 11 and 12, and this time we're on chapter 13. So I don't know if anybody read ahead or not. Yeah, it's an interesting chapter, this one. Okay, so the chapter title is Working with Unwanted Thoughts and Emotions. Anybody ever have those? Like, all the time. You know, it's like, oh, why am I thinking that? Or I don't want to feel that. What's going on? So this is a chapter written by Russell, you know, the psychologist. He's a hidden Buddhist. Won't even admit it to himself. But we think quite a bit along the same line. So he says, a major obstacle to self-compassion is the tendency to blame ourselves for our own thoughts and emotions. Okay, so we talk a lot about self-compassion, the importance of accepting ourselves, having a kind attitude towards ourselves, and so on. But what really gets in the way of that is not just having thoughts and emotions that we don't like, but criticizing ourselves for having those thoughts and emotions. Okay? Noticing that we're having thoughts that run contrary to our values, we may blame and shame ourselves. I'm a terrible person. What a hypocrite I am. This can also happen when we find ourselves feeling emotions we'd prefer not to have, or emotions we've been taught we shouldn't feel. So we notice jealous thoughts and criticize ourselves. I'm so greedy and selfish. We observe fear and anger and quickly label ourselves. I'm so weak. I'm out of control. Okay, so much self-judgment. You know, we have the negative thoughts or the unwanted thoughts and emotions. That's one level. And then we exacerbate the situation by blaming ourselves for having them. And then we can blame ourselves for blaming ourselves for having them. Okay. We may think this self-condemnation helps us, that somehow if we attack ourselves enough for thinking and feeling things that we don't like, we'll change and become the person that we want to be. So, I'll tell you a little story before I read the rest of this paragraph. There was a young man who came here for EML, Exploring Monastic Life, 1 year. And he had a lot of self-criticism going on. He was a vet, and I suspect that some of the things that happened in combat were weighing heavily on him, and he was criticizing himself for that, or for just thoughts and feelings that he didn't want in general. And I remember talking with him about it, and you know, him saying, well, I've always treated myself that way, been really hard on myself. And I said, why? You know, what good does it do? And he said, I'm afraid if I'm not, that my mind will just get out of control. I'm afraid that if I'm not critical of myself, I'll just be very lazy and I won't make any effort to do anything good. So his self-criticism was really based on a lot of fear, you know, and thinking that the self-criticism will get him, by criticizing himself, he thought it will get him to do the things that he knows he needs to do. Yeah. And so I said, well, does criticizing yourself get yourself to do the things that you know you need to do? And he said, no. Yeah. And I suspect if every one of us looks inside and all that kind of criticism that we have for ourselves, you know, doesn't really work to lead us to change in the way we want to, most of us would say, no, it doesn't work. Yeah. So then the question is, why do we keep doing it? Yeah. Well, a lot of it is this, I think, this kind of fear that this young man told me about. So in my experience in working with people, I think that this self-criticism is one of the biggest obstacles we have, not only to spiritual practice, but also just to having a happy life now, here and now. Okay, because we get so tangled up with woulds and shoulds and ought tos and supposed tos, and that we really can't think clearly in the end. Okay, we may be afraid that if we aren't hard on ourselves, those undesirable thoughts and emotions will wreak havoc in our mind, causing us to lose control or giving ourselves permission to misbehave. So that's part of the fear. Yeah. However, the problem with attacking and shaming ourselves is that it fuels our sense of being threatened and keeps us stuck in feeling angry, anxious, and defensive. In the previous chapter, Russell had talked about three kind of psychological orientation principles, you know. One was a threat system where we felt that we were either going to be physically or emotionally or in some way threatened by somebody else. The second one was a drive system wanting to achieve or get something. And the third was a safe system where we felt relaxed and secure and safe. And so he was saying that the threat system, when it gets triggered, and it can get triggered by somebody saying or doing something, but it can also get triggered by our self-criticism. That's what I'm finding so interesting, because when I read this sentence, I went, whoa, you know, the problem with attacking and shaming ourselves is that it fuels our sense of being threatened. So we're threatening ourselves by, you know, being so critical and shaming of ourselves. And I wonder, I think actually we blame and criticize and shame ourselves often much more than other people blame and criticize and shame us. Yeah, we may have heard some blame and criticism and shame when we were kids, you know, a little bit or even a lot. But the problem now is not that those people in the past blamed and criticized and shamed us. The problem now is that we're doing it to ourselves. Yeah. Nobody else is sitting there picking on us. Yeah. I mean, in school, we may have had kids who picked on us. But who, you know, are people really picking on us now? Okay, maybe your boss or colleague says something once in a while. But how much do we do it to ourselves? And I think that's one of the big problems. Yeah. And it's such a problem because a little thing, even an innocuous thing, somebody else says or does, can trigger that shaming, blaming system in us. So then we think the other person is doing it to us. But they just made some kind of comment. Yeah, but we took that comment and latched onto it and then made it into something that we torture ourselves with, basically. Okay. This mental state isn't fertile ground for cultivating compassion or other positive qualities. That's an understatement, isn't it? Yeah. Shaming ourselves reinforces qualities in ourselves that we are ultimately trying to change. Okay, so it's like shooting ourselves in the foot. Yeah. The qualities were such that we're trying to change, such as being judgmental of others. Yeah? So here we are, so judgmental of ourselves for being judgmental of others, and we want to stop being judgmental by being judgmental. Now you see what the Buddha meant by cyclic existence is craziness, you know? Finding the best way to work with difficult or unwanted thoughts or emotions requires skill. We need to stop blaming ourselves. He put that in italics. Stop blaming ourselves for thoughts and emotions that arise in us as a result of our previous conditioning and experiences. And at the same time, step up to take responsibility for working with those unhelpful thoughts and emotions and for cultivating more helpful ones. So what's the difference between blaming and shaming ourselves and taking responsibility for things that we don't, qualities that we, and thoughts and emotions that we wish we didn't have? You know, do we know in ourselves what the difference is between blaming and shaming and taking responsibility? Because I think we get these very confused in our own mind. Yeah. We think that if we're going to be responsible, then we should blame and shame ourselves. Okay. And there's this thing, I think, in Christian culture especially, that the more we repent, and here repent doesn't mean simply confessing and making amends. It means beating ourselves up. You know, I've got to repent because the evil's in me, the devil's in me, whatever, you know, beat myself up in some way. That we think that the more we make ourselves miserable, the more we're purifying that negativity. Okay. So the worse we feel about harming somebody else, the more we're purifying and making amends. Does that make sense? Okay, think about it for a minute. Does trashing yourself do anything to undo harm? Or does it create more harm? Yeah. It doesn't purify what we did. It doesn't help the other person. It harms ourselves. But we have this weird thing in our culture that you can't really purify unless you're miserable. And so here's where Buddhism is very different from that Christian way of thinking. Because in Buddhism, when we do purification practices, we imagine light and blissful nectar coming from the Buddhas and filling us up so that we feel bliss. And that purifies our negativities. Very different, isn't it, than, you know, thinking I've got the worse I feel, the more I purify. In Buddhism, it's the more I can forgive myself, the more I can connect with the positive sides of myself, like connecting with the Buddha nature, you know, and activating that. That's what the, you know, visualizing the light and nectar coming into us does. You know, in Buddhism, that's what helps us to purify. It's a very different kind of take on this, isn't it? Yeah. And, you know, really when we look at it, we're a very guilt-ridden culture. Don't you think? You know, in this country, very guilt-ridden. Except it seems like most of the senators don't feel that way. Sorry, once in a while I have to make a remark. Yeah. Okay, refraining from blaming and attacking ourselves doesn't mean that we're being self-indulgent or irresponsible. We accept that these troublesome thoughts and emotions exist in our minds and know that it's our job to resolve them. So that's the part of taking responsibility. These thoughts exist in my mind. I'm the only one who can really deal with my mind. So I'm responsible in that way. But having those thoughts does not mean I'm a horrible person. It means I have some work to do on myself. But it doesn't mean I'm hopeless and sinful and evil and unworthy and all that other garbage. At the same time, aspiring to cultivate our minds in ways that fit with our values doesn't mean attacking ourselves when we fall short of our goals. Okay, so to not expect ourselves to be perfect right away, you know, we have this aim and we're working towards it, and to rejoice at all the small steps we take going in that direction. Rather than continually fueling our own threat responses by criticizing ourselves, we want to stimulate our drive and safeness responses, creating a sense of, and space of safety from which we can work with scary or challenging thoughts, feelings, and situations, and inspiring ourselves to act in more compassionate ways. Okay. So learning to work with our own mind instead of creating more fear and threat in ourselves by blaming and shaming, you know, to have a sense of acceptance that opens up some space. So accepting ourselves for what we are now does not mean that we never try and change. It means we accept the present situation, you know, and why not? It is what it is, so might as well accept it. And then we know the change can come in the future. Okay? So that I think, is an important key. Rather than rejecting the present situation, saying, it's bad and it's horrible and how can I think such things? You know, okay, I don't like it. But those thoughts and feelings arose. But I don't need to act on them. I have the tools to remedy them, and I will work at doing that. Okay. And that's being responsible.
Consider a recent example from one of my, Russell is speaking here, one of my therapy groups. Jeremy, who had a history of physical and verbal aggression, had been working to reduce his angry behavior and to cultivate more kind, understanding ways of relating to others. One day, an acquaintance harshly criticized Jeremy about his past in a way that he experienced as very hurtful. Although, gee, Kavanaugh should have listened to this. sorry, I should be quiet, huh? Although Jeremy handled the situation adeptly, telling the other person that he wasn't willing to discuss his past with someone he didn't know well, and that's reasonable to say, you know, I don't know you well, I don't want to discuss my past. He did that, okay, but still he became embarrassed and angry, okay? Observing his anger, he became very self-critical. There I go again. I'm not making any progress. This is hopeless. Crestfallen, Jeremy told the group about his quote-unquote failure. But instead of condemning Jeremy as he was condemning himself, the other members urged Jeremy to stop being so self-critical and to take a second look at the situation. So those are friends, people who do that for you. With their help, he was able to see that he had actually done a good job at handling an uncomfortable experience, avoiding both aggression and harsh speech. Further, they helped him to recognize this as a situation that would be hard for anyone. It hurts to have your past thrown back in your face when you're doing your best to improve. And rather than beating himself up for getting upset, he could consider what might help him feel safe in the face of such harsh criticism. So, before going on, what would make you feel safe? How, if you received some harsh criticism about your past, what would make you feel safe in the face of that criticism? How could you look at yourself or talk to yourself or think that would create a sense of safety within yourself? Because you're not going to get the safety from the other person.
I would think that I have changed. I have done a lot of work to improve myself, and I am no longer the same person that this person is holding on to and seeing. And so give myself some credit for the work that I have done, and hope that at some point this person might be able to see that and appreciate the change as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good. To look at how you've changed and give yourself some credit for that. Yeah. Okay. It's important to be able to look back and see how we've changed. Yeah. It's important. Instead of always judging now, to look and say, wow, what was I like 5 years ago? Yeah. Are you a better person now than 5 years ago? Yeah? So let's give ourselves some credit for that. Yeah, quite important.
I think there's an important step that comes first, and that's actually acknowledging that we have something in the past that we regret. You know, if I was thinking about going through 12-step programs where you have to acknowledge that there were mistakes. Mm-hmm. And a great way to continue to sort of atone without thinking of atonement is to deny that really happened, but really kind of not think so good about ourselves and beat up and beat up and beat up, so that you can't really take the step that acknowledges until we go, yeah, I really did mess up. Or yeah, there really were things that I regret now that...
Yeah. So regretting, actually the Tibetan word that we translate as confess or repent, it actually means to split open. So it's this same idea of, you know,
if there's something we don't like about ourselves because we messed open, instead of burying it under here, let's split it open, air it out, clean it up, resolve it. Yeah. Because it takes a lot of energy to deny to ourselves and to keep up the rationalization. It's much easier just to say, whoa, I messed up and I regret it and I'm going to change.
Sometimes the mistakes are not so far in the past. They're rather current.
And like so, 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. And so one thing that I'm trying to remember is to say, wow, that's a really deep habit that reaction has come up again. Mm-hmm. And so I need to try to be aware that that's a strong habit and apply more antidotes, but also to give myself a little bit of a break, that there's a lot of momentum behind that habitual way of thinking or acting.
Right.
And also know that I'm working on it.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a bad habit and I'm working on it. Yeah. So both of those elements are there. So in the situation with the group with Jeremy, this coaching worked. And after practicing over a few more similar situations, Jeremy learned to notice and redirect his criticism of himself before it got the better of him. At various times, we have all kinds of thoughts, kind thoughts and cruel thoughts, sad thoughts and happy thoughts, supportive thoughts and judgmental thoughts, nurturing thoughts, and wildly spicy sexual thoughts. Oh, I'm a nun. Am I supposed to say that? Well, that's Russell's words. He wrote this chapter. That goes with the territory when you have a human mind. Some of these thoughts will surprise us, particularly if they are very different from how we like to see ourselves. If we see ourselves as a kind person, we may find ourselves dismayed when a cruel thought leaps to our mind about that person who just cut us off in traffic. Yeah. We can find ourselves trying to drive these thoughts out of our minds or ignore them in the attempt to avoid the discomfort they cause us. Okay, like, go away thought, go away. Blame it on Russell. It turns out that these strategies, suppressing or ignoring troublesome thoughts and feelings, don't work very well, do they? Yeah. They really take a lot of energy. Research shows that trying to avoid thinking of something actually makes us more likely to think of it. So it's the old thing of don't think of a pink elephant and what comes to your mind. Yeah. It also keeps us from dealing with the situation. If we are able to accept our unwanted thoughts and emotions for what they are, we can approach them without fear, anger, or revulsion, and to work to replace them with compassionate thoughts. Now, when he says we can accept unwanted thoughts and emotions for what they are, and here I think it's very interesting to ask ourselves, what is an unwanted thought or emotion? Is it something physical? Yeah. Is something outside that's going to harm you? No. Is it, you know, does somebody else have control of your mind and making you think things such that you're truly out of control? No. Thoughts and emotions are just blips of mental energy. They're powerful, but they don't have arms and eggs and arms and legs. And they don't throw eggs. And they don't throw nuclear bombs. You know, they're just blips of mental energy. So we don't need to be so afraid of the thoughts and feelings. There's a blip of energy. It arises, it ceases. I had a friend who was a hospice nurse, so she's been in some pretty interesting situations, grueling situations. And she told me that people cannot hold on to a very distressing emotion for more than like 30 minutes, even if they tried to. You know? And I think that's actually a long time. If we really look at ourselves, you know, can you make yourself feel sad for a half an hour and keep that mental state without thinking about anything else? Yeah. Our mind is constantly changing objects. It's constantly changing emotions and thoughts. Okay. So instead of regarding unwanted thoughts and feelings as some kind of permanent thing that are always there, or thinking of them as, okay, here's the surface of my mind, and these are under the surface, you know, sea, like sea monsters under the surface of my mind, ready to go, you know. Yeah, from Buddhist psychology, it's not like that. It's not like we have under the surface, you know, anger that's ruminating all the time, ready to explode. No. It's, you know, you have blips of anger, and then you have seeds of anger. But the seeds of anger are not manifest, and they aren't consciousnesses. Yeah? So it's not like we're always angry or we're always sad or whatever it is. Okay? So to not regard our mental states as fixed and unchanging. It's similar. Okay, so he said last thing. To approach them without fear, anger, and revulsion, and to work with to replace them with compassionate thoughts. It's similar to being at a dinner and being given a plate of food we don't like. For example, cabbage. I'm with you, Rafa. I like some kinds of cabbage, but not too much. We can try to pretend the cabbage isn't there, but that doesn't get rid of it. And it doesn't get us something we can eat either. Okay? Accepting an uncomfortable emotion doesn't mean we decide to like it. It means we acknowledge its presence and consider our options. Okay, so accepting that I'm upset doesn't mean, oh, I like being upset. It's fine to be upset. It's good to be upset. It doesn't mean going along with that emotion and, you know, encouraging it. Yeah, it means identifying it, accepting that it's there, but knowing we can change. In the case of cabbage, we could eat it anyway. Leave it and eat the other food on the plate, or politely ask for something else. Similarly, accepting what we are thinking or feeling doesn't mean we endorse these experiences and want to continue having them. Rather, acceptance creates a place of safety from which we can work with our internal experiences. Working with our experiences means that instead of ignoring, denying, or simply trying to push unwanted thoughts out of our minds, we try a different strategy. So here comes the strategy. Noticing unwanted thoughts as mental offense, we accept the presence of these thoughts without following or engaging them, and gently redirect our minds to more helpful thoughts or experiences. Okay, so we accept there's that thought, but I'm not going to follow up on it. Because it's, you know, either by saying, okay, there's this horrible thought, either by saying, oh, but there's something enticing about that, you know, I have the thought, I'm so jealous, I want to beat somebody up. What would they look like if they were black and blue? You know, it's not following up on it. Like that. And it's not saying, oh, you're so bad for having it. Okay. It's just, okay, there's that thought. Yeah, you accept the presence of the thought without following or engaging in them. And then gently redirect our mind to more helpful thoughts or experiences. Okay, I'm jealous of somebody. Feeling jealous feels is really an icky feeling. It's not a very pleasant feeling. Yeah, there's got to be another way to look at the situation so that I can release the jealousy. Yeah. So, you know, you think, well, I'm always writing on Christmas cards, may people be happy. So here's somebody who has a good situation, and I didn't even have to lift a finger to make it happen. Yeah, so my Christmas wishes are getting fulfilled. Let's rejoice that this person is happy. You know, why do I begrudge them a little bit of worldly happiness that is so temporary that it's, you know, not going to last long? Huh? Can I get political for a minute? I just think of Kavanaugh, you know, like, oh, I'm a Supreme Court justice. I've made it. I'm so happy. Do you think that that is going to make him everlastingly happy? Yeah? Do you think he's going to be continually happy from being on the Supreme Court? He's going to have a whole bunch of problems. Yeah. A lot of problems. So, you know, okay, he feels happy now. I don't want to begrudge him his happiness. I don't think he should be a Supreme Court justice, but he is. He's happy. Let him be happy. But the poor guy, mamma mia, is he going to have headaches? You know, this is not going to bring him everlasting happiness. No way, shape, or form. Yeah. So, you know, often the things that we get jealous about, you're jealous of other people for, if we really look what those situations are, we see that they're going to bring those people a bunch of problems too. Yeah. So are we jealous? We want to have their problems too? Yeah. Yeah, it's so strange how we sentient beings think sometimes. This approach invigorates our efforts by helping us reconnect with the motivation to improve the world and ourselves by practicing compassion. Similarly, you know, they interviewed Mitch McConnell, yeah. And he said, this is the best thing I've ever done as a senator. I'm just completely blissed out. And I thought, are you going to be everlastingly happy from doing this? Yeah. Really? Really? This is going to make you happy forever? I don't think so. For example, if we notice ourselves delighting in the misfortune of someone we don't like, instead of beating ourselves up because we're delighting in their misfortune, we can respond differently. And now here comes a bunch of points. So first point, accept and acknowledge the thought or emotion. I notice I'm enjoying how much she is struggling. Okay. Second point, empathize with ourselves and redirect ourselves towards our goal. It makes sense that I feel and think this way given how my relationship with her has gone in the past. Okay, that's the part with empathizing yourself. Here, I don't quite agree with Russell to say it makes sense that I feel and think this way given how my relationship with her has gone in the past. As if saying it makes sense, as if justifying that thought. I have a different way of approaching it when this thing, this happens. I don't say to myself, oh, it makes sense that I have this horrible thought. I say, you know, I would say like in this situation, okay, we have a history of disagreement. Yeah. So this kind of thought may habitually arise in me. But I don't say it makes sense that I would have it. Yeah. To me, there's a difference in it. Is there a difference to you? Yeah. If I say it makes sense, then in some way it's somehow justifying it in terms of just saying, okay, given the past conditioning, yeah, this kind of thing may come up. I accept that. But the second part of this point is thinking, but I want to be a compassionate person, not someone who delights in others' misfortune. So that to me is what I do. I may say, okay, you know, this horrible thought came up. I don't want to be the kind of person who rejoices in others' misery. That's not a quality I admire in myself or in anybody else. Okay? So I want to be a more compassionate person. So then that starts to like shift. Where am I going to direct my energies now? So then the third point is, feel good that we notice this habit and now have the opportunity to work with it. Thinking, I want to change this kind of habit and work to cultivate compassion in my life. Good thing I caught myself thinking this way. Okay, so there you rejoice. You give yourself some credit. Okay, sure, it's a lousy thought, but I'm making progress because I caught myself thinking it. In the past, I wouldn't have caught myself at all. I would have jumped in and really indulged in, you know, rejoicing at somebody else's misery. But, you know, I am making progress, so give myself some credit for that. And put your glasses back on. Okay, then the fourth point. Bring up a compassionate motivation. Thinking this is an opportunity to see the benefit of having compassion for people who push my buttons and to generate that compassion. Deep down, I do want her and everyone else to be happy and not to suffer. Okay, so to think, you know, I'm trying to, you know, work on myself. And so here's a very good opportunity to do so. Yeah. And I can see the compassion, you know, that I want to develop compassion and get in touch with my deepest thought, which is really at the end of the day, I don't want to wish anybody harm. You know, I want to wish people well. And then the fifth point, gently shift our minds to a thought that reflects our commitment to compassion, such as, may she have peace and support as she copes with this challenge. Yeah, so wishing the other person well. It doesn't hurt us at all to wish somebody well. You know, if anything, it smooths our own mind. Though it is easier to attack ourselves than to practice this more lengthy compassion approach. And it's only easier to attack ourselves because we're familiar with that and habituated to it. Okay. The compassion approach is much more likely to create positive changes in our minds without creating more unhelpful thoughts and emotions. For example, Jenna, a student, would sometimes observe herself having very critical or cruel thoughts about one of her classmates and was appalled, thinking, she just seems so smug, and I thought, she's so awful. I hate her. I hope she fails this test. I couldn't believe that I wished that for her. I feel like such a terrible person. So there's the self-criticism coming up. As she examined her feelings, Jenna became aware that the negative thoughts she had about her classmate were prompted by feelings of threat. What was triggering this? Feelings of threat. For example, the classmate had achieved a higher score than Jenna on several previous exams. Jenna's feelings were then magnified when she attacked herself for having negative thoughts. I felt like I not only wasn't as smart as she is, but that I was a bad person as well. So you see, the initial negative thought, I'm not as smart as she is, and then the self-criticism, I'm bad for thinking like that. Once Jenna was able to notice her negative thoughts and evaluate them, she found herself able to practice compassion both towards herself and her classmate. I was feeling threatened, but that wasn't my classmate's fault. She's just trying to do the best that she can, just like me. Attacking her doesn't make me feel better about my test scores, but maybe there are other things that would help me feel more confident. Yeah. So what do you think that Jenna could think that would help her feel more confident rather than comparing her test scores to her classmates and then judging herself? How could she feel more confident?
She could study more or ask to study with Jenna.
Yeah. No, she's Jenna, criticizing the class. Yeah, so she could study more herself, or she could ask to study with that classmate.
Or even just rejoicing what she's doing right now, not seeing that she's in a position of lack, but just saying, you know, I'm doing my best. I can only do that. What more can I expect of myself? And just encouraging herself that way.
Yeah, saying I'm doing my best. Also saying, you know, okay, my friend may have more aptitude in this class, but I have other talents, and I don't really need to compete with this other person. We're unique individuals. Yeah? So this is the way, you know, we have to think of how can I think to create a sense of safety within myself. Yeah? That's really important, learning how to change the thoughts. Did you notice how when I asked you for that, there was silence at first? We really had to think, how do I create a sense of safety in myself? Okay? But this is really something I think quite important to do, how to calm ourselves, how to create that sense of safety.
I want also to add as an understanding where the threat comes from, you know, digging a little bit. So tracking it back where I've been threatened before. And so what's the original cause for that?
Yeah. So she could say, you know, what past conditioning have I had that brought up that thought? Yeah. But I don't know, that may create a sense of acceptance. I've had this past conditioning, so that thought came up. But I think you need to take another step to create the sense of safety, to say something positive, not you like that, not just to analyze where the negative thought came from. We're very good at analyzing our negative thoughts, okay? But we need to learn how to think of positive ones that are realistic and bring those to the surface. So that takes another step in our training.
I was going to say that it's also not a one-time deal, that we have to see it repeatedly to recondition ourselves to think differently and to create a new habitual pattern, because we've grown so used to the criticism, the judgment, that unless we put as much effort in undoing it, we're not going to be able to do it.
Yeah. So, but we have to put the effort in, don't we? And slowly, slowly, we'll see the progress. Instead of wishing ill for her classmate, Jenna was able to notice the real issue, her own fears of not doing well. So actually, she's saying, you know, my wishing her ill really has nothing to do with her. It's coming from my lack of confidence. Yeah. Furthermore, she found that cultivating compassion for both herself and her classmate thinking we're both trying to succeed in a really demanding program. Yeah. Help them develop a relationship that improves their performance. They began studying together, which also provided social support that helped reduce Jenna's stress. Okay. So I think that thought, you know, here, thinking we're both just trying to succeed in a really demanding program. You know, thinking that equalized the situation somehow. Instead of she's better than me, I'm lesser, I need to compete to become like that, it's we're both trying to do our best, and this program is indeed demanding. You know, equalizing the whole thing. I think that's nice. They began studying together, yeah? Similarly, it's not helpful to attack ourselves for having human emotions such as fear, anger, or lust. These emotions will sometimes arise in us, and it's our responsibility to find ways to work with them. As we discussed above, shaming ourselves for having these emotions simply creates more challenging emotions for us to cope with, creating a cycle that can easily end in avoidance, denial, and more sufferings for ourselves. Here, too, we start by accepting our emotions and then generating other thoughts and emotions, such as compassion for others and ourselves, that can help alleviate these difficult experiences. So Jeremy, who we spoke about earlier in this chapter, gives us a good example of this. After his groupmates helped him to recognize that he was needlessly attacking himself, he continued having occasional experiences of irritation and anger and was sometimes tempted to criticize himself for it. Instead, he learned to coach himself through these episodes. So here's how he coached himself. He's thinking, I'm getting angry again, and I'm feeling a bit frustrated with myself. But look at how quickly I notice the anger. So giving himself some credit for what he's doing. I was able to step out of the situation and calm myself down before things got out of control. Good for me. And I was able to come back and resolve the situation without getting aggressive. Another good for me. Yeah. I never would have done that before. So seeing how he's changed. Even the fact that I grow frustrated with myself for becoming angry shows how committed I am to becoming a compassionate person. Okay. Being compassionate doesn't mean I'll never grow irritated or angry. It means taking responsibility and working with these difficult feelings when they come up. And that's what I'm doing. And so in that way, he really created that sense of space, safety, and shifted his mind and encouraged himself. Yeah. As Jeremy got better at noticing his anger and beginning to view himself and others with compassion, we're going to be late. Practice patience. Don't get angry at us. We love you, Venerable 7K. And we know it's lunchtime, but we got to finish the chapter. Okay, so Jeremy's thinking, it's hard to work with anger when you've struggled with it all your life, and I'm making real progress. Now that's a good way to think, isn't it? You know, I have a pattern with this. It's hard to struggle. I mean, I've struggled with anger my whole life, but I am making progress. Good.
I think that I noticed in what you just read that I find very helpful also in my own situation is defining things quite clearly. So what does progress mean to me in this situation? You know, what does reframing mean to me in this situation? Because then once this is very clearly outlined in my mind, then I can actually see, oh yes, I am meeting my own definition. It's not somebody else's definition. It's my definition based on my situation and what I can do and how I can do it right now.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the whole thing of learning to evaluate ourselves, which is so important because we're the only ones who really know what's going on inside of us. Yeah. And so learning to see what's going on and knowing our situation and, like you said, and not taking somebody else's standards or the standards that we used to have for ourselves, like I should be perfect by tomorrow. You know, here's the bar. I'm angry now. I've got to stop being angry. The bar's way up here, you know. From tomorrow onward, I'm never going to get angry. Forget it. You know, set the bar a little bit lower and, you know, notice our progress. Okay, so when he did this, he found the anger and irritation arose less often than before. He also observed that when he wasn't fueling his threat system with self-critical thoughts, his anger dissipated much more quickly, replaced with a sense of safety and confidence in his ability to handle his emotions when they came up. Okay, so the benefits of not antagonizing our own threat system. As we work over time to replace troublesome thoughts and emotions with more compassionate ones, we will establish new compassionate mental habits. Gradually, the frequency and strength of our disturbing thoughts and emotions will start to decrease, while the compassionate thoughts and emotions we've cultivated will naturally increase. We'll notice that troubling thoughts and emotions seem to come less often, and that other thoughts and feelings, those that reflect the sort of people that we want to be, will arise of their own accord. We'll observe our tendency to make quick judgments about others being replaced by the ability to slow down, look closely, and understand a difficult situation. Anxiety and anger will come less frequently as we notice ourselves feeling safer, more confident, and more fearlessly able to engage with all that life has to offer. And then there's a reflection at the end of the chapter, which I'll leave you with as some homework. Working with unwanted thoughts and emotions. Think of an unwanted mental experience, such as cruel thoughts you may have had about somebody, angry or fearful thoughts you have experienced, or other feelings to which you usually respond with self-blame. That's step one. Then imagine working with them by going through the process described above. So begin by accepting and acknowledging your unwanted thoughts or emotions. Okay. Then empathize with your own experience and then release the thoughts and emotions, not by pushing them away, but by redirecting your mind towards your motivation to cultivate compassion. Okay. Then feel grateful that by noticing this experience, you now have an opportunity to change. Okay. Then generate a compassionate thought or image in your mind, wishing the other person and yourself well, envisioning both them and you having peace, happiness, and all the conditions enabling you to be at your best.